Okay, thank you, Jaroslav, and thank you for inviting me and getting me here. It's a very exciting place. I decided to talk about the subject smart magnets spintronics. The idea is, I know most of you are theoreticians. Of course, I can provide now an experimental point of view and said I might give you some stimulus. What is interesting? What are the areas to dig deeper into it? So I try to give a little bit of picture what smart magnon spintronics is, and maybe the easiest introductory view graph is just this one. You all know that it's just the number of transistors you have on an integrated circuit. So the number of transistors you see here, you see as years, and you see as a linear slope in a logarithmic scale. And every 2 years, the number of transistors doubles. And if you read carefully the Bible, which is the International Technology Roadmap for Semiconductors, you see a prediction that starting from the end of the year, the doubling does not happen every 2 years anymore, but every 3 years. So this technology is really coming to a saturation. So we need to find something new. And I think that is a motivation we all have in our field, especially if we work in basic science, to find something new which could be useful. I'm not claiming, and I must make this disclaimer here, that we have already the technology of the future. But what we have here is really some ideas which might turn into that, but the way is still a long way to go, and we are still at the very beginning. And I think we are very much in this exploratory phase where basic science meets some ideas from the applied science, and I find it always very lively to be in such a stage. What are we talking about? Magnons. Not electrons anymore, magnons. And who doesn't know what a magnon is? This graph, I only show if no, there is at least one person who does not know what a magnon is. It's for the students already. Well, a magnon is very simple. You just have a, let's assume the easiest magnetic system you can think of, it is just a chain, yeah? And all these moments are ferromagnetically coupled. So that is a ground state. And if you want to excite it, what can you do? You can just take out one of these moments or spins and turn it back just with the opposite direction, and you might have noticed the magnetization, the sum over all these moments, is just reduced by 2 units because you have taken out one and taken back with the opposite sign. If you do that, this costs you a lot of energy because you have to break the exchange energy here and there. That is very expensive. And there is a cheaper way how to do it, and that is simply just to cant all the moments just a little bit so that you have the same quantum mechanically argued decrease of the saturation magnetization by 2 units. And again, if you now do about 1.5 pages of very simple algebra, you find out that is not the solution, but the solution is these moving moments, because of course you have to deface the entire thing. And what you have here is just a magnon. A magnon has a wavelength. A student made this very nice animations, and see a smile on your face. It's always nice to show this. That is Blender. Yeah, that is Blender. So we have the wavelengths, we have a wave vector to pi over the wavelengths, and so magnons might be used as elementary excitations. And the idea of magnon spintronics is, of course, to use now the magnons as a carrier of information. What are we discussing here? Most of you, at least those who I know this all, but so I will go rather quickly across it. If you have these precessing moments now in a 2D or let's say 3D system, you see a magnon propagating here. If you have a trained eye, the underlying equation of motion classically is the Landau-Lifshitz torque equation. It's a torque equation, so the time derivative of magnetization is equal to the cross product of the magnetization with an external field. You see it here. Here's the external field. Here's the magnetization. So the cross product points here in this direction. So you have the precession here. And if you look at this, you see this magnon here has a wavefront, because all these moments here precess exactly in phase. You can assign the wave vector, as you have seen in the view graph before. You can measure the wavelengths even with your eye, because this spin and this one here are precessing exactly in phase. And I show you this view graph here simply because the message is you have magnons which propagate in all different kinds of directions. So it's a very useful object. Okay, magnonics, electronics, spintronics. Electronics, you know, you do data processing with electrons, CMOS technology. You can switch to spintronics. That is also now widely accepted. You use, in addition, the spin of the electrons. You have things like the GMR effect, the TMR, spin transfer torque, and many, many new things. What I find so exciting is that in spintronics, every 10 years, you have a major breakthrough discovery was a Nobel Prize, and I don't know that many other fields who every 10 years can produce such a big advance. And now we go to magnonics, and what we use here is again the spin, but the carrier of the information is not the electron anymore, like in spintronics, but just the magnon. That is said. So we have no flow of real particles, and people who know what flow of real, especially charged particles, means can become very happy, because if you move charges, you have, of course, always losses, and you want to avoid losses. So potentially, magnonics has a can be done with much lower energy dissipation, therefore smart magnon spintronics. But it's still a far way to go to them. Well, what can we do? What are the parameters? Wavelengths we can down to the nanometer scale, even down to the atomic scale if you like. So there is a large space to explore. Frequency can be from gigahertz up to terahertz. And the free path, and that is a good message, can be up to centimeters. And so we can really transport information over a larger distance. And those of you who are really in spintronics, you know that the spin diffusion length is a very short entity. And so magnons over electrons have the advantage. They can propagate over larger distances.
Also have magnons in gigahertz?
Sorry?
You said gigahertz, but you can also have them in principle at megahertz.
If you in principle, you can have everything. You just have to find a material with a very, very low saturation magnetization. You have to handle the domains in this case. And yes, but nobody is really trying to. That is very difficult,
because it means
you have a tremendous request regarding magnetic shielding and so on, because the fields are so low. So just takes a Lamour precession, and then you can scale what the fields are.
Sorry, one question. Is there any subtlety about how you define a free path, mean free path for magnons? Because, I mean, magnons are not like electrons. I mean, they're not, particles numbers not conserved. I mean, what is your real definition of a mean free path?
The mean free path is simply, when magnons are coherent per se, as a quasi particle, it's like phonons. You just see how much, how long is the distance by which the amplitude is decayed by 1 over E.
So if a magnon split into three magnons and then recombined and stuff like that, wouldn't affect the...
That would affect, yes. So not things like coherent scattering. I mean, it takes a real bare propagation distance, the lifetime of the
magnon. But how do you get such so long then? I mean, you have to... Is that at very low temperatures? I mean,
No. That is all room temperature. That is in materials with a very low spin orbit coupling. I'll show you this a little bit later in the talk. Of course, you have materials with much shorter distances. I mean, that is, of course, best typical example. But it's nice, dipolar interaction can be used. And the nice thing about the dipolar interaction is that the dispersion depends so much on the geometry. It is really very fundamental textbook knowledge, but I would just like to show you because we need it for the rest of my talk. Dispersion, frequency of as a function of the wave vector, that is for a film of thickness d, so this is dimensionless here. And just depending on where you propagate, whether you propagate perpendicular to the field, like here, or parallel to the field, you get very distinct dispersion properties. Here's a green for perpendicular propagation, the red curve for parallel propagation. If you have the external field perpendicular to the film, you get the blue curve. And already you can see some peculiarities you don't have so easily in other systems. For instance, this mode here, it has a negative group velocity. And it's called a, hello, Ichi. It's called a backward volume magnetostatic spin wave for this reason. Backward, because if this is the phase velocity, group velocity is in the opposite direction. So in a sense, this mode runs backwards. So that is a commonly used term. How do we do experiments? The most simple experiment you do is just you take a magnetic material. It can be yttrium iron garnet, a material we like very much because it has the lowest damping of any practical material. GGG, gadolinium gallium garnet, is just a substrate. And then we just put a little metallic stripe across it. We put a microwave current through the stripe. And then, of course, you have the dynamic Oersted fields, and they excite the spin waves, and they can propagate. Very simple, done since many, many decades. Just to show you what can be done, let's look into this backward volume mode you see here. What you could do is you can do a very simple experiment. What you see here in black is just a piece of a waveguide made out of yttrium iron garnet, just a stripe. Yeah? So the dimensions, the cup is about a centimeter from here to there. And then you see three antennas here made out of gold wires. We just only use here in these experiments the central one. And then what we can do is we use this backward, we excite this backward volume mode. So we apply a field along the stripe. And then you get, we can measure actually with time and with space resolution the amplitude of the spin waves. The technique is called Brillouin light scattering, which you can do where you focus laser light on the sample and you then watch how these spin waves propagate. And here is just an experiment what you see, and you see very nicely here in the middle is the antenna, how now two spin wave pulses are excited using a microwave pulse applied to the antenna. They run to the ends, and what happens here is just the analog on what you all know from optics. This is nothing else than a waveguide for spin waves. So you have a typical waveguide profile, a maximum in the center of the waveguide here, and it decays towards the edges of the waveguide, and they run here in both these two directions. So this can be used, so we have already a way how to transport information, if you like, using these kind of devices in principle. The material we like to use is yttrium iron garnet, in a sense an artificial material because it is not compatible with CMOS at the moment. Lots of people are working, trying to get this compatible by either making ultra-thin YIG films or searching for other materials. I will show you an example. All we need to know is just a material with a very, very low damping, then it has a saturation magnetization, and that is all we need to use here. Okay. Just as a reference, we have, of course, research programs also in my group to search for other materials. This is actually done with a very nice collaboration with people in Sendai who are very good in making these materials. These are Häusler materials, cobalt, iron, manganese, silicon. And here you get already decay lengths of the order of several micrometers. This is not millimeters like in YIG, but this is much larger than any spin diffusion lengths you can have in a metal. If you take for comparison permalloy, which is also very often used in the community, typical decay lengths here are of the order of only a couple of micrometers. So this is already three times better. There's lots of room for further improvement. The research is just starting for the material scientists here.
And what's the temperature
there? That is all room temperature. The nice thing is these magnons are very well detached from the real world. I mean, what you have in YIG is only some residual spin orbit coupling, which is very, very weak. So you can propagate over long distances for this reason. Similar holds for these Häusler materials. The matter is, of course, how to couple into and how to detect these kind of materials, these kind of excitations. Excitation is easy with an antenna. You can also use a receiving antenna. You can use spin Hall effect, inverse spin Hall effect, spin pumping to detect it. There are several means, but this all is subject of research.
What is the wavelength here?
The wavelengths here is, I have to check what it was here in this case. Let's say, this is good on light scattering. This is, let's say, half a micrometer to a micrometer.
Sorry, maybe again I'm confused, that's very simple, but I mean, when you're talking about magnons, I mean, are you really talking, I mean, how many magnons are in this wave? I mean,
you're plenty.
Yeah. I mean, this is why I'm a little bit confused. I mean, if I compare this to a line width of a magnon that you do at low temperature with neutron scattering or something like that,
yeah.
I mean, would I get the same distance out of that? So I've got a feeling you're actually got packets of thousands of magnons.
Yeah.
You're not really talking about propagation of a single magnon, are you?
No, we are not. We use two terms. One is magnon. One is simply the classic term, which is spin wave, which is just composed of the magnons. And these are long wavelengths I'm talking about.
These is in the magnons. I mean, yeah. The spin wave here is a pretty classical object.
Yeah, it is a classical object. Yeah. It is classic, but sometimes it's not, because if you have three magnon processes, four magnon processes, these are, of course, quantum mechanical processes, which you cannot describe so easily. In a pure classic fashion.
Because that's what I'm worried about, the subtlety of the length. Because I mean, a single magnon, you can decay as a single magnon. But here, what's conserved is the total magnetization. So if you change the number of magnons, it's not going to change the total magnetization. But it could.
It can. It can very well. It can very well. I mean,
coherence in a single magnon.
Yeah, of course. It can very well, because. We see the reduction of the saturation magnetization experiments, then we just have plenty of magnons. what I show you here is just linear regime. We can easily go into the nonlinear regime. I will show you some nonlinear data later. You will see that you have the entire field available. As long as this is linear, of course, you can just think about a superposition of the magnons, and it becomes nonlinear as soon as the magnons start to interact. And the easiest way to describe, make good theory of nonlinear processes is, of course, discussing in a language of non-interacting, of interacting magnons. Yes, this was all meant for the introduction. I'm not yet there where I would like to take you. Last piece of introduction, because this I need a lot in my talk, is magnonic crustal. You all know a photonic crustal. You just modulate in one direction one material property, or you can do it in two directions. I'm only talking about one-dimensional magnonic crystals today. And the nice thing in magnetism is if you want to make these kind of magnonic crystals, you have many ways how to do it. The idea is simply that if you have this modulation, you get reflection or partial reflection of the magnons or the spin waves at certain places in the magnetic crystal. And if this is all coherent, then you get the Bragg reflection. And this is fulfilled if a multiple of the wavelengths of the spin wave or the magnon is just two times the periodicity of the magnetic crystal. Standard condition you know from many, many areas in physics. And let's just see what happens if you have just the dispersion. This is the backward volume mode. You have seen this dipolar mode with a negative group velocity, and I plotted just for both directions, for both propagation directions on this side and in that side with respect to zero wave vector here. Then if you have a magnetic crystal, this is the experiment, again, a Yix stripe, some antennas which you have here. What you can measure between this antenna and that antenna is that transmission function, which looks like this. It has an upper cutoff and a lower cutoff. That is simply due because of the dispersion properties, because you have a maximum frequency for this mode at zero wave factor, so you are here. And then the efficiency of the excitation decreases with increasing wave factor. The wave factor increases from here towards lower frequency. Remember, this just has a negative group velocity. And so that is a classic transmission which we measure in such a, let's say, reference experiment. And now if we just, let's say, put in some grooves into our Yix-Stripe periodic grooves, and at each groove the spin waves can be reflected, they do superposition, you have Bragg reflection, and what you get is two things. First of all, in the dispersion you get the characteristic opening of gaps, what you see here. And in this transmission, which we directly can measure, we see now here the dips in the transmission, because at these dips the Bragg condition is fulfilled. The spin waves get scattered back, they can't reach anymore the receiving antenna, and so we have already a device. It's a notch filter, if you like. You can design it in a way that it is easily adapted to what you might need. I show you this formula not to discuss the origin. The origin is just, let's say, 1.5 pages of standard analysis. That is a frequency as a function of the wave vector of a spin wave in a waveguide, a classic waveguide. Yeah, no magnetic crystal yet. And quantities which enter are the external fields, the saturation magnetization, the width W of the waveguide, and the thickness of the waveguide. So it's just geometry here and saturation magnetization. We assume anisotropy is zero. But I'm showing this because this tells you how to make a magnetic crystal, because the good message is you have many ways how to make magnetic crystal. For instance, you can change the field here in your system. Changing the field, we have done just putting this meander type wire on cross of this magnon's waveguide, and then if you have this wire, you will see it will modulate the external field. Or you can change the thickness, which you see here. We just make some grooves into the magnetic crystal. We can change the saturation magnetization, for instance, by interaction with a surface acoustic wave, which we do here. You have a transducer to induce the surface acoustic waves. It makes some standing wave patterns, modulates the saturation magnetization. Or you can change the widths by simply just, this is a micrograph, having here a material where the width is periodically changing. So many ways how to make magnetic crystals. I don't want to go through all the details, but I just wanted to show you what is possible. So if you want to think, where do you want to maybe start to think about the problems, there are many ways where you can just tap into this interesting field. And now it's time just to tell who the people behind my talk. There is Andre Chumak, who is a senior scientist in my group, just looking for a job at the moment. American system, he's an assistant professor. Same with Vitaly Vazushka, a little bit younger. Alexander Serga is a senior scientist in my group supervising all these spin wave activities. And there are a lot of collaborators. I would like to mention Mikhail Kostilev, Alexei Karanoska, Mikhail from Australia, Alexei from Oxford, Andrei Slavin from Auckland University, also Vasil Tibakevich. We have a lot of collaboration also with E.G. Saito, but not on the subject I'm telling you today. So E.G. is not here on the U-graph normally. On 90% of the U-graphs he is. And then it's a group behind, so I have about a group of about 30 people in total who are just connected with everything regarding spin waves. What I would like to show you now are just a few highlights. One is the Marknon transistor, where we can control Marknons by Marknons. The other is how parametrically driven crystal, where we can show data buffering. And then there is another interesting thing, which is all linear time reversal, which you can use for pulse shaping, for instance. And that is done with a dynamic Marknonic crystal. So let's, I think, get started with a Marknon transistor. And the background you have already more or less learned already. Just your introduction, electronics, we have seen it involves the flow of electrons. The biggest problem is joule heating, and we need to find ways how to avoid it. What we have shown in the field of magnonics is that you can do data processing. So just on a weekend, just for fun, we have done an experiment showing that if you have two of these magnonic waveguides, we can very easily build logic gates out of it. It's a really primitive experiment because all we do is just we have a microwave generator, we excite spin waves here and there, we let them propagate, we let them electronically interfere, and you see, if one of these waveguides now has a phase shift, then you get interference patterns as a function of the phase shift. And you can easily introduce a phase shift by simply putting just some additional magnetic field here. Because, you know, Marknons is just, essentially it's just Larmor precession. Yeah? And if you increase the field, of course the precession gets faster. And if you decrease the field, the precession gets slower. Yeah? How do you can change the local field? Simply put a wire across it. The wire will add or subtract to the static field. And therefore, you get a phase shift in the spin waves. And what you see here is just a measured phase shift here as the outcome as a function of the current through such a wire. And you see it's a nice linear relation as you would expect. And so it works very nicely. It doesn't work very well in terms of energy consumption. It uses much too much energy, but it's just a prototype. We did it on a weekend, really, believe me. And we published it in one of our very highly cited papers because the community obviously jumped on these kind of experiments. So this, you can have any kind of logic gate, AND, NAND, NOR, this kind of thing. What you see here is just an XNOR, because you see if the phase shift is the same in both, which means both wires are fired or not fired, then of course you have constructive interference and then you get a logic 1. And if you have only a phase shift in one of these two branches, you get a logic 0, because then here you see the data, you have the interference here in the data. So it works very, very easily.
Everything is classical, right?
Everything is classical. No quantum computing.
There is no way to go to Bell inequalities with magnons?
We are looking into it. It's an interesting question. We are looking into it, but so far we don't have any results I can show you. There is one big, let's say, problem with this field, that is there's so much to do. We constantly have to decide what will be the next direction, and sometimes you decide for the directions which the papers are closer, then you still have a very hard way to go. We do it step by step. The problem is input is DC pulses, so we have currents, DC currents. Output is Marknon packets. That is nice, but not so nice as you would like to see, because what you would like to do, think about an all Marknon computer 20 years from now, of course, we want to control Marknons by Marknons. That is important. This we can't do this way, because we constantly have to switch between electric currents and Marknons. And you can think by yourself about the usability of such a logic gate. A nice demonstrator, but still far away. So we came up with the idea of building a Marknon transistor. We now want really, like in a real transistor where you control electrons by electrons, we want now to control Marknons by Marknons. And how it looks like, you see already here, we have a magnonic crystal made out of yttrium iron garnet for the demonstrator. We have an input antenna and an output antenna. We just look into the transmission functions here. And this is only to generate the magnons and to detect them. You can omit them if you like. If you have another source of magnons, you can use another source. It's only a source and detector, nothing else. No data processing by these antennas. And then we have another antenna here in the middle that is just to create some other magnons here in the middle. And if you want to understand where I would like to go to, just consider it as a field effect transistor, as a magnonic analog of a field effect transistor. So this is a source, we call this a drain, and this here is then the gate. And of course, the idea of the field effect, you know very well, you want to control the electron flow between the source and the drain by some manipulation of the channel here in between. And same idea here, we want to control the flow of the magnons from the source to the magnon drain by some manipulation of the area here in between by other magnons, of course. And so this is an all magnonic device. Source to drain magnon flow should be controlled by magnons in the transistor's gate. How can we do this? Well, what you see here again is a transmission function for a magnonic crystal. And you see here now the dips because of the Bragg reflection condition fulfilled. You can have the dips very deep. You can change the widths just by the geometry. So we have that. And now what we can do, we can choose a frequency for the magnon transport from the source to the drain by just going here on a point where the transmission works very, very well. So at this here, we should have maximum transmission. And then we can use another frequency for the gate magnons. And here we choose, and you will see in a second why, a frequency which sits just at one of these gap positions. And if that happens, then something interesting is going on. Because these magnons are sitting here in the gaps, they can't propagate anymore because they undergo constantly Bragg reflection. So they cannot propagate. So this magnonic crystal acts as an enhancer of local density of magnons and therefore of nonlinear effects. And here you have the nonlinear effects now kicking in. And the good thing is, and that is all the magnonic crystal is needed for, that in this way, thresholds for nonlinear phenomena is very, very much reduced, because with the number of available magnons, if you allow me to say it in this language, it's very low, because the magnons can't move away. They are just staying where you inject them, and then they can do nonlinear processes. Well, the idea is very simple. If there is nothing happening at the gate, all the magnons from the source can travel from the source to the drain region. If we now bring in here, in this magnonic crystal area, these gate magnons, what will happen? We have the nonlinear processes. They start to scatter with those magnons who want to go from the source to the drain. And each magnon scattered cannot reach the drain, and therefore, of course, the current is reduced. And in the worst case, just for a given larger density of the gate magnons, all the magnons who want to travel from the source to the gates are scattered and no magnon is arriving at the gate. That is basically the idea of this transistor function works. You see the analogon here for the field effect transistor, where just this voltage here at the gate just narrows down the channel, and then finally no electron flow can happen between source and drain. Well, the experiment we do is we just apply a magnon pulse to the source, and then we measure the magnon density here at the drain. And after some time, this magnon pulse has just traveled through this entire structure, and then you see here at the output a nice pulse. And this is without gate magnons, and if you now just allow for some gate magnons, this is just the microwave power. It's a microwave generator we do. You see that we very nicely can suppress the magnon flow from the source to the drain. So this works very nicely. And what is actually happening here physically? It's four magnon scattering. So you have four magnon scattering simply means you have two incoming magnons. They are scattering, and you have two outgoing magnons. This happens all under conservation of energy and momentum. And effectively what happens is if you have a source If you have the source magnons here, you basically take two source magnons here, you scatter them somewhere else in the spectrum. Here you see the entire spectrum. You see the negative slope. This is a logarithmic scale now. As you have seen before, at some point, exchange interaction kicks also in, and then the frequency increases. And basically, you're moving these magnons to that regime. What happens here is the group velocity is very, very low. These magnons can't reach anymore the drain region, and therefore, you have kicked out these magnons from the transport properties. What you can do is you can measure the magnon current suppression as a function of the gate magnon density. A zero gate magnon density, of course, has no suppression, so the factor here is unity. And then you can define a threshold. You call everything above logic 1, everything below logic 0. And then you can do data processing, digital data processing, if you like. And the interesting point is the number of gate magnons to need to define this threshold is much, much, much lower than the number of magnons you need to supply by the source. So you see directly here you have an amplification factor here of 10, because only with a tenth of the number of magnons at the gate you can already switch the system between logic 1 and logic 0. So magnon control, the magnon principle was realized. And the nice thing is that now you can, of course, change these kind of elements. You have two frequencies, but you can imagine two of these devices in series, then you are back at the original frequency. So in principle, proof of principle, not more, you have now a tool here at hand to build some logics built only on magnonic devices with no conversion to electric voltages forth and back in between. So things work. I was mentioning this is just a proof of concept. We are at an early stage, and you see directly if you really look what is the power involved. CMOS uses 3×10⁻¹⁸ joule as a characteristic quantum of energy you need for a switching process. We are 3 orders of magnitude away, but there's plenty of room, of course, to improve. And this is our work for the next couple of years to come. Let me make here a side remark. What you can do is classical computing, and that is what you do here in your laptop. You have a scalar variable, you have Boolean logic, everything is 0 and 1, and you have, of course, deal with things like very fast processing and so on and so on. The next step which could be done is going to wave computing. The nice thing is you can now work with vector variables. You don't have Boolean variables anymore. Because you can think, for instance, of the phase, of the intensity, and these can be vector variables. And this allows you already, and I will show this in the outlook at the very end of my talk, to build devices with much less number of components than you need for conventional digital processing. And then, of course, you can do the next step. You can go to quantum computing. That is a very different way, where you again use vector state variables. You have items like entanglement. We have already things like what I would call a classical analog of entanglements in our wave computing. If we use magnons due to some special processes like parametric processes, so we have some intermediate step here which we can use. So the idea is.
Do you need some special algorithms for that?
Yes.
So both of the tasks you can do are very specialized.
Yeah. The algorithms exist in principle. They need to be, the math has been done or like these kind of things many years ago, but of course it needs to be adapted.
Yeah. Quantum computing, the number of problems you can access is very, very limited.
Yeah.
Is the same for wave computing?
No. I show you in the outlook. If you allow, let's just wait for the outlook, and then I show you a device which you want to do next, in a nice European project. Okay, so let me now switch a little bit to parametrically driven crystals, and the issue is to show that data buffering can be done. Again, the magnonic crystal, you have seen it. What you might also know from the photonic crystal, a big issue there is slow light in these photonic crystals. And the idea is simply that the group velocity here can be made very, very small, and then the light just stays there for some time. Question is, can we do it with magnons? And just to tell you the answer ahead, yes, in principle, but we have a much better means how to do it. And I will show you this. What do we have? We have, again, the dispersion, Magnolia crystal, the band gaps, which correspond to the dips here in the transmission function here in between. And now let's see what we can do. Yes, if you see that, you see slow magnets here already. If you have a little bit experienced eye, you see the group velocity here becomes very, very low at the band gaps. Yeah, so can we slow down the magnets? Theory can be done using a transfer matrix approach. This has been done by Mikhail Kostilev. And the transmission might look here like this. And if you now look into the spin wave group velocity, you see here the experiments in the dots, and you see some simulations here in red. And you see, indeed, you can reduce the spin wave group velocity, but not very, very much. There's some effects there. So if you like to tweak it, you might be better, because here you see that you can get it fairly low, but still, this is only a factor of two you can achieve. You cannot really bring it down to zero. Yeah, here it is 20% at this point. So no wave deceleration and storage is possible? Question mark, I will show you that storage is possible. Since we have also another tool here, and that is parametric amplification. You all know what parametric amplification is. You know the swing. The case is a little bit easier, even in the case of spin waves. Let's assume, and this animation should explain it, you just have here a precessing moment. And what happens is that this precession usually is elliptical, because the dynamic stray field force that the precession has is kind of elliptical shape. It just takes a lot of energy to take the magnetization out of the plane. And as a result, you see that the Z component is oscillating with twice the frequency of the precession itself. If you now apply a pumping field with also twice the frequency, you see you can couple to the Z component and you can make the precession much larger. That is a very nice and very commonly used amplification mechanism here in spin wave physics. How do we do it? Basically, very similar setup as before. We have a magnetic crystal area here, a waveguide. We use an input-output antenna just to get the magnons in and out into our system. Here is a resonator, a dielectric resonator, where we now want to do the parametric amplification. We provide an input pulse, and if we do so, immediately, I have to tell you, because I'm an experimentalist, you might not be interested in this at all. Immediately, you will get an output pulse because it is direct electromagnetic coupling. You always get it. But we can separate very nicely because of the time structure. Then we have a spin wave pulse traveling, and after some time later, you see the output pulse here. This is time scale. Now, what we can do, the spin wave pulse was traveling through the entire system. Now, what we can do some time later, we can just apply a pumping field with twice the frequency, as you've seen before. And if you do so, the result is we get another spin wave packet here. And the question is, what is going on here? I can skip that. Well, what is going on here is just, I like to call it a contrail phenomena, but since we're here in Santa Barbara, we better take this kind of idea. You have a ship, and the ship always has some kind of wake behind it. And the same happens to our magnons if they travel through our magnetic crystal. Because just see, that is a dispersion you have seen here before. And what you see here in this yellow curve is just the spectrum of a propagating spin wave packet. And you see, because it's a short pulse, it just has a fairly large frequency range here. It's not so large, but on the scale it's fairly large. So you basically cover here this entire area. And what you can do so is just, you can just excite here these localized modes, yeah, which are just confined in the gap to the magnetic crystal. These modes which are constantly scattered forth and back inside the magnetic crystal. And then these modes stay there. Yeah? And that is a contrail. And actually, if we do a Brillouin light scattering experiment, then we see here, this is time scale, propagating pulse. And that is a snapshot at a given point in time. You see here the pulse, and you see some stuff here behind which looks very much the same like this wake here behind the ship, just compare that area to the area before, you see the additional intensity here. Just the same thing, we can directly image it. So if this wake exists here, and if we now start sometime later, let's say at this point here, yeah, but the ship is already gone, the ship is our spindrift pulse. If we now start parametric amplification, but we can use that here as a seed to the parametric amplifier and restore the original parts. And it only happens if you have the wake. If there is no wake, there's nothing to start from, then this amplification doesn't work. So indeed this works, you see it here. That is parametric amplification. We have now in quantum mechanical language, we have a photon which tries the frequency of the Machnons. We have wave vector conservation, so we have two Machnons, two correlated Machnons with the same frequency, same phase here, but opposite wave vectors. That is, you were asking for entangled state, that is the, our analogon to an entangled state in this still classic field. And they just stay here, and we have then here these staying, these standing waves because of the Bragg reflection conditions. Well, yeah?
In principle, you can come to so-called dynamical localized vision, right? You have a classical system, you can come to chaotic regime, like...
Oh, you can easily, yes. But what's a chaotic regime here? Yeah, you can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you achieve your goal, right? If you localize and quote-unquote your magnons, mm-hmm. then you decelerate them very much. Right?
Yeah, it's not the acceleration, it's just that you have an overlap with these localized modes, which are just bound by the Bragg reflection because they scatter forth and back, and then you later on with parametric amplification you can restore the original parts. And actually you can do it with phase conservation, so you have still the same phase, and that is very, very important, very interesting point in terms of coherency of these entire things. And then what you see here, if you look at the restored power, what you get a large signal here, exactly here at the edges of your band gaps, yeah, of the magnetic band gaps, exactly at the positions where, of course, the Bragg reflection happens. So it works, so we can store information and we can retrieve it. Of course, we cannot store it for too long because the standing modes also decay, but this is a different time scale than the propagation time. We have seen in experiments. So new eigen excitations exist in the magnetic crystal, I discussed it, and they are quasi-normal modes having standing character but interact with the propagating spin waves, and so we can do it. Okay, let's go now a little bit step farther, and I show you now my favorite magnetic crystal we have, but that is a dynamic magnetic crystal. And well, let me show you some preliminary experiments first. Preliminary studies. What we can do is, for instance, we can propagate a spin wave packet across a film, what you see here, and then we can put a wire across. You have already seen wires across in this very first logic experiment. If you make the wire, if you put a strong current, DC current through this wire, it acts like a local gap. Yeah, so locally the spin waves cannot travel here, so some spin wave packets are reflected, some other spin waves might tunnel through this region where now propagation is prohibited and can propagate here on the other side. What you basically do, you reduce here locally the magnetic field by the Oersted field generated in the current here of the wire. Yeah. You can play games. For instance, what you can do, you can have a YIC waveguide, not a magnetic crystal, just a waveguide. You have two wires. And I would now like you to show an experiment we have done a couple of years ago. And the experiment goes as follows. We fire this wire here, the right wire. Yeah? Then here, the local field is basically reduced to a very, very small value, let's say zero for simplicity. So spin waves cannot travel anymore through the wire region unless they tunnel through this region because the width is very narrow. Then we let a spin wave propagate, and as soon as the spin wave pulse is here, we fire the second wire, put it under current. Yeah, and then we basically confine the spin wave pulse here in between, and it will be scattered forth and back between the two wires. Exactly what you know from your Bragg condition. And this experiment I would like to show you, and it is here. Oh, sorry, it is here. And don't start it here, separate. And this is now again, Brillouin light scattering, space resolved. And you see now very nicely, how it works. Here, you see the spin wave pulse coming in the experiment, and now the second wire is fired, and you see how it is confined. Some part of it can still tunnel through these regions, and you saw the wave packets going out of it. And I think that is a nice demonstration how really Bragg reflection and these kind of things can work. For the dynamic magnetic crystal, the results I would like to show you now, we have done a somewhat extended version. What we have done here is just putting electric wire, in this meander shape fashion on top of our spin wave waveguides. You have a periodicity A here. We apply a field here parallel to it. And we have an input and output antenna just to generate and see the spin waves. What happens if you put an electric DC current through the wire, you see the Oersted fields just alternate from wire to wire because the current direction alternates. And that is the magnetic field. The films or the magnets will sense. It will just oscillate here with the periodicity here of your wires. Well, if you do the experiment, now you can really adjust with the DC current strength your performance of your magnetic crystal. Transmission curve, as you have seen before, if we now switch on too much current, of course, you get only noise. Sorry, what is this? The point is simply if you bring it too close, then you get some additional effects which you don't want to have. In this business, this is a message for the experiments. You have to be careful because you also get sometimes a direct influence because of eddy currents you generate by the magnons. Let's not consider it here. If we do the experiment like this, you get very nice notches here in the transmission function, so you can use it as a very nice filter. If you increase the current, you see that now here these dips here become much broader, and you can tune it as you like. What is nice is that this dynamic magnetic crystal can be switched on and off very, very fast on a 10 nanosecond timescale. That is fast on our experimental timescale, and that is faster than the relaxation times which you have. So you now have two systems. You have one dynamic system, which are the magnets itself. And you have another dynamic system, which is just the system itself, and you want to know how does a magnon or a spin wave in such a dynamic system behave. And of course, you get a lot of interaction between the two systems. What will happen? Some of the stuff you have seen, but let me just illustrate it once again. Let's assume we have no current. Yeah, then we have the standard dispersion you see here. And now, if you put a current through the wire, the gaps will open. And what will happen? That the Bragg reflection sets in, and the energy is now transferred from this point by just the periodicity of the magnetic crystal, 2 pi over the periodicity, to that point on the other branch. And if you wait a little bit, the same thing will happen in the opposite direction. So you get, in a sense, two coupled oscillators between the magnon modes, which can travel here inside the magnetic crystal. And this corresponds to what you know just from two coupled oscillators. And the question is, can you see the beating frequency here in between? And in fact, indeed, you can. Here is an experiment where you see two magnon modes. Time is running between t equals 0, then just one period, then two periods. And you see very nicely in the experiment how the intensity is shifted from the right peak to the left peak and how it oscillates. And if you plot the transmitted signal here for this case, you see very nicely how the transmitted signal here in black and the signal of the backscattered, which is called a reverse, of the backscattered signal which goes back to the input antenna also oscillates, and they, of course, here out of phase. This works very, very nicely. So directly in the experiment, we can show. We have played here a little trick just by shifting it a little bit with respect to zero, but this can easily be done in a system. I show you this a little bit better here in this view graph. We have seen that you can shift energy from this point to this point. What about if we now excite here at this frequency point? Then something very interesting happens because you still shift by 2 pi over the periodicity. And in order to do so, you end up here at a higher frequency. So you can use it as a frequency shifter. And that this works indeed is that it's a reflected frequency measured as a function of the signal frequency. You see the negative slope. So with increasing signal frequency, the reflected frequency goes down because you are here. So you have a frequency shifter, which you can dynamically adjust if you need an adjustable frequency shifter, which works on a 20 nanosecond time scale. So here it is. you can do more. You can, for instance, inverse frequency, because assume I have an entire frequency spectrum here, these two peaks, so the small one is a circle, the big one is a square. If you now shift it again here to the other side, then you see that now the big one, the square, here has a higher frequency and the circle has a lower frequency, just opposite what you have here. So you can invert a small part of your frequency spectrum if you look for that. Now, what about the time profiles of these pulses? Well, let's assume we have an input signal of two pulses and it propagates here in this direction. Then you switch on the magnetic crystal by switching on the DC current. Then, of course, you have the Bragg reflection and these two pulses will, of course, run back in the opposite direction. And that is a linear process. We are not talking about nonlinear processes here. Yeah? So if we have two pulses, one and two, then you see that after some time, they will be reflected like you see here. And if you like, because what happens is that these two pulses change their order. The same thing like you have seen the frequency here before. And this just corresponds to time reversal inversion, to time inversion. You can see it very nicely here in this nice animation. If you have an antenna here, and you let a small and a large pulse propagate, and here you build a reflector, then what happens, it will just be reflected like this. And you see that always the small pulse leads the large pulse. You've seen it, yeah? What happens if you do it in a magnetic crystal? Because the magnetic crystal acts like a face mirror. You see, it descends back as it is. And now on the way back, the large pulse heads the small pulse. And of course, you can imagine this as nothing else than time reversal, because time reversal simply means you let the movie run backwards. And so basically, here the movie is running backwards, so you have time reversal thing. And you can do it with any pulse shape. So if you need to invert the time structure of a pulse, which is interesting in analog gigahertz signal processing, you can do it. There's no way to do it with computers, by the way, because no computer is so fast that you can do this kind of reversal electronically. That is basically what I wanted to tell you. So before I show a quick outlook, conclusions is Magnon's proposed an alternative to electronics for data processing, so the potential is there. We need to explore it. The way is long to go. I showed you that magnon-based data buffering can be realized in principle. I showed you an all-linear time reversal is demonstrated. We can shift frequencies, so we have a lot of handles on this. And now, what might it be good for? Let me show you one device. And this device is a very simple one. It's a majority gate. A majority gate is a very, very simple logical device, which you can, of course, realize with CMOS, but there is no point to realize it with CMOS. And the idea is very simple. It always has an odd number of input lines. Yeah? And now you have signals which you generate somehow here. The signals have a phase, and the phase should be zero or pi. And the question is, what is the output phase? And the way of operation is nothing else than there's classical interference. So the output signal will always have the phase of the majority of the inputs. Yeah, because if one phase is pi and the other is zero, then of course they will interfere destructively, so they don't make a contribution, and then the third one here will win. You need to amplify it after that, which you can do with parametric amplification, as I have showed, to normalize the output signal again. And then the output signal has just the phase of the majority of the input signals. That is a very, very useful thing. And together with a phase shifter, which basically inverts the signal between 0 and 1 and 1 and 0, you can show that you can build the entire logics family with this kind of devices. And what is very, very nice is that you can build, for instance, a half adder or full adder with much less number of components than if you use conventional CMOS logics. So if you are able to have this kind of interference logics, the savings in space you need in F square is already quite significant. There are many open questions, and I think that is why we are here. The maybe most urgent problems we have is, of course, things like spin-orbit interactions, spin-orbit torques. Can we detect spin waves electrically? Can we generate spin waves electrically? Here you see already that we generate in this sketch spin waves by using the, for the experts, by using the spin Hall effect, but that is still a mystery whether it works. We need to change phases. We can do it electrically. Electric is always bad because this costs energy. Are there other means? Can we use just some other magnetic fields? Jeliushinsky-Maria interaction is a field, is a subject which has not been really addressed here for this kind of dipole exchange modes. It's a very, very beginning. What is nice about Jeliushinsky-Maria is it has a cross product in it, and it has a derivative in it. So it has all the ingredients which you have spin. And if the expert might remember the Landau-Lifshitz torque equation I showed at the very beginning, you have there a cross product and you have a time derivative. And of course, you can also easily generate out of this spatial derivative. So we have things very similar to the Jeliushinsky-Maria, at least in a sense. So how can we combine it? Cross product always means that you break time symmetry. And you see that in the spin waves, we have nice modes which are not time symmetric. And so there is, I think, plenty of room for further development. I cannot address you. Damping is an issue. Can we switch off some of the damping mechanisms? Yes, we can already, and we might further improve of it. For instance, if you have a spin wave propagating, the easiest thing is you have a spin wave propagating in a parametric oscillator regime. It gets, of course, amplified, not damped anymore, because amplification is larger than the damping. Another is to use the inverse spin Hall effect, and several groups, including us, have shown that you can have amplification of spin wave. And then, of course, here it is. We need new algorithms for wave-based data processing adapted to our spin wave scenarios. That is, of course, another community we need to talk to develop that. But as long as I'm working in this field, the field is moving slowly, of course, because there are many, many fundamental things. But there is no brick wall yet where I would think let's better do something different because this would not go. So I think there's lots of interesting physics to discover and to come. And the hope that sometimes it might even be used for things like smart magnetron spintronics is at least there. Thank you very much for your attention.
So we have plenty of time for discussion.
I have one basic question. So in this kind of harmonic crystal, we always use this backward rotation mode is a negative hook velocity.
Yeah.
Was this essential at a certain?
No. We can also use the surface mode.
And
yeah.
So why did you use that one? Or is it, I mean, not just in particular?
Yeah, because it's good. It's good. Yeah, it's good because first we have another research interest in that as well. That is Bose-Einstein condensation. And the guy behind you, Jaroslav, is very much interested in Bose-Einstein condensation. Of magnons as well. There's no reason to confine to backward volume modes. You can use the surface modes, and it should work equally well.
Although the chiral surface modes, they have again different properties, right?
Yes. So the problem is we have done it. We have compared surface modes. The Bragg scattering is a factor of 10 weaker, which you need to compensate by deeper grooves or, if you like, the dynamic magnetic crystals, higher currents. No, it's not surprising. Because of what we call sometimes chiral protection. Yeah. Yeah.
But you can also have magnetization perpendicular, right? And you would have surface modes which are not chiral.
They are not surface modes. See, they can be surface modes. So there's a forward volume modes. They're normally volume modes.
Yeah.
You can do magnetic crystals with them as well. We have not tried yet. Yeah.
Another question. Yeah, can I ask another one about this kind of the wave computing? Because I think, isn't there this kind of like analog computing? And one of the problems with analog computing was, it was discussed maybe very long ago, but I mean, one of the problems was the error correction, or the kind of absence of error correction, because I mean, analog computing basically all errors kind of role, that this digital, you kind of can make error correction because at a certain stage you kind of have more error. So is there some way of doing error correction, or is this included in the algorithm case?
Honestly, this I don't know, because that is not my field of expertise. At the moment, I see for the next steps to go, I just see interference logics, but digital. So that basically means you have to condition us in between, which makes sure that you have a logic 0, logic 1, and that the regions are well defined. I mean, this, what you might have understood, you can do all. I mean, you can do digital processing, you can be multi-level processing if you like, if that is a future, I don't know, I'm not the expert in that. You can do analog. I mean, analog means naturally high frequency signal processing. So if you have, for instance, if you have pulses, then you need to convolutes, you have convolution problems. For convolution, it is very useful to have a time inverter. Yeah, convolution is not used, to my knowledge, and again, they are not the real expert in microwave and advanced microwave technology and radar technology and so on and so on. Yeah. If you now have a physical means to do on-the-spot convolution, you can imagine by yourself what's the field of application. We don't have microwave. I mean, this will certainly go into the military microwave devices. We don't have that in Europe, so I have not the contact. I can't tell you.
So another naive question. I mean, what would stop you using anti-ferromagnetic magnons rather than ferromagnetic magnons? Is the problem of coupling to external things?
Nothing fundamentally. The anti-ferromagnetic are interesting because of the much higher frequencies. You need to find means how to excite them, so you would probably go via ferrium with some ferrimagnetic material. I mean, Yick, by the way, is ferrimagnetic. Yeah, but we are not looking into the higher modes. As I just said, this field is broadening, and constantly we have to decide: shall we go for the dynamic magnetic crystal? Shall we go for name something else, Lushinsky-Moria interaction, and of course you go there where you have the best chances to get funding and to get the next papers out and so on and so on. It was good that we went step by step in order to understand the things. There are many intermediate steps where people have just done single shot experiments which, you know, by statistics 50% of them or even much higher are wrong. So, I mean, we built really now step-by-step understanding what is done and what is the potential behind. And things like, if you like, the Lushinsky-Moria interaction or antiferromagnets are on our list. We have invested a lot in exchange bias in the past. That is also a field which is very, very interesting in this context here, because with exchange bias you can easily switch and can use that even as permanent storage elements for spin waves, if you like.
Someone asked about bell measurements, and you mentioned you're looking at that. What kind of experiments are you considering?
Sorry, what?
Yeah. What kind of experiments are you considering to deal with, you know, more quantum correlation like bell measurement?
Yeah, there's plenty. A little bit, but only a very little bit was shining through, maybe. We are not in the quantum limit in the sense that we do single Mach non-generation and detection. That is far away. Probably you have to go to use some magnetomechanic devices, because with these little mechanic devices you can have single quantum detection, has been shown for phonons, and maybe a way to go is to couple these phonons to a Machnon or something like that. But we have the quantum processes. This is a particular 3 Machnon, 4 Machnon processes. 3 Machnon I could not really address here in my talks. 3 Machnon processes can be very pronounced. They are still a mystery, because 3 Machnon processes means you have Machnon confluence or Machnon splitting. This means you have two incoming Machnons which combine to a new Machnon, or one Machnon splitting into two other Machnons. This all happens with energy and momentum conservation. That is simple, but not with angular momentum conservation, because a Machnon exchange Machnon has an angular momentum of h bar, or mu naught, depends what you like to talk. And you see this quantity is not fulfilled. We know that three Magnum processes need dipolar contribution, but we don't think that on its own this is conserved. So you need to have some other mechanism to involve the lattice in order to maintain that. And that is still not clear. To me, it's not clear. Yeah. We have done interesting experiments, for instance, doing three Magnum processes in the presence of a platinum overlayer, which provides a very nice means to couple via spin orbit coupling between the Magnons and the lattice, and there we see characteristic inverse spin Hall effect signals. Yeah, which says there is a net spin current, obviously, in order to fulfill the three Magnon stuff. Also, colleagues like Sergei Demokritov has studied it to some extent, but it is still not fully clear what is going on there. But this you cannot discuss, to my view, in a classic picture. Then you are really in quantum limit. And things like Bose-Einstein condensation is a quantum phenomenon. At least that is what the majority in the community believes. And I should really say there's still a small fraction who thinks there's something like a classic analogon of the Bose-Einstein condensation, but that is not yet discussed to a very end.
So regarding those back gap reminiscence
studies, what is a typical lens?
There's a resonance with the propagating modes you have seen. That was basically what I was showing.
That was a non-linear.
For the Bernoulli crystal, yes. But this is contrail modes I showed you, so this is wake modes. That is not nonlinear. What is nonlinear is, of course, a parametric amplification after that. But the generation of these wake modes, that is, of course, a linear process, because simply just a hybridization of these modes.
And what is the typical?
Again, this depends on parameters. It could be typical in our experiment. Yeah, it should be typically a micrometer and below. Because it's the same wavelengths like the modes we are studying. Yeah, of course. It's a group velocity. It must be below. Yeah.
Also, I have a simple question. That was not a stupid question. Now I'm referring to others who said I have a stupid question. Not
so what can you do with microons, what you cannot do with phonons, for example?
Phonons are also very similar type of excitation.
Yes.
With which you can do also, in principle, interference experiments.
Yeah.
So where the microon is really essential?
For instance, non-reciprocity. I have not seen a non-reciprocal phonon. Then the dispersion is different. I mean, we have much more. I mean, show me a phonon with a negative group velocity.
Yeah, but you emphasize that you do not need the negative group velocity.
Oh, it has big advantages if you want, because yes.
That was the
Volkmann
question, right?
No, I understood your question. Is it possible to build a magnetic crystal with positive group velocity? Yeah. Yeah, for instance, Bose-Einstein condensation, you need a minimum in the spectrum. And that is easy if you have...
You can create this also in special crystal structures.
You can, of course. Yes, but not so easy.
Of course, you do know what you do not have in phonons, I think, are these.
Yeah, what is
something which only exists.
Yeah, magnons, sometimes the answer is extremely trivial. And my trivial answer is, if you have a magnonic waveguide, you have no magnons outside. If you want to do it with phonons, you either have a wire in vacuum, then you have no phonons outside, or you always have a leaky problem.
Okay,
I don't know whether you take this as a...
I see asking on the principle one. So one is certainly that these Damon Eshbach models, I think there's no analog of that.
No.
But is there some more than that? Principle.
Isn't this Spintronics program?
Yeah, but I think there is no problem asking questions.
Yeah, do you have three phonon processes from four phonon processes?
Oh, yes, that is non-phonon harmonicity.
So yeah. We have non-linear anharmonicity. That's right.
Anharmonicity, yes. They also give these kinds of processes.
Yes.
Optical phonons also
can have a negative group velocity. That's right. Yes. And we have also optical Mach nonce, but. It is, yeah, not.
Any clever questions? for the first one, so you made a FET, kind of the gate of spin wave, which can be controlled by spin wave. Basically, it's a normally off gate.
Yeah. Is it possible to make a normally off gate used by that?
What do you mean with anomaly?
Normally on. So now, when the gate is, when the gate spin wave is
outside. That you mean with normally on, yeah.
Normally on gate, if it is, it's a spin analog of the normally on gate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible to make a normally on gate in their CMOS electronics, say, coexistence, but normally off and normally off gates are very important for the efficiency. So if you can make the normally off gate, it is very advantageous.
I mean, if I understood you correctly, the way we have designed it, it's a normally on gate, yeah, because we need the gate Mach nonce to suppress the source drain Mach nonce current. Then we would need a different mechanism.
Do you have any idea for
that? We have not really thought about it yet. We're just happy to have this and to bring this now to some conclusion and to show that the gain can indeed be a factor of 10, which we find very good for the very first attempt. And I mean, of course, just using several of these devices, you can make a normally off gate into a normally on gate, but just by chaining. But that is not what you're asking. You want to have a single device which is normally off. Yeah.
So all these materials now, these are just monodomain, right?
Yeah. In external fields, you get it easily monodomain.
No magnetic impurities, right?
Hmm?
So there are no magnetic impurities. They are free of any magnetic impurities which magnets can scatter on.
Yeah, that is a big issue what you're addressing now. The model systems we have no acting impurities. That is why Yig is so good. It's single crystalline, no grain boundaries, and so on. The name of the game is, of course, if you want to push it farther, is to miniaturize it. These are large devices, yeah? And then you have several choices. One, you go to ultra-thin Yig, which exists. People are making, including Professor Saito, are making very, very thin Yig films. But these are usually polycrystalline, and therefore they have a damping, which is already a factor of 10 worth compared to of the order of 10 worse compared to what you have seen here. So someone has to see, how can we trade it? Other groups are trying to push the limit of liquid phase epitaxy, the method of liquid phase epitaxy, towards thinner layers, which is a big metallurgical problem. Other looking into different materials, like the Häuslers. The data I've shown you, these were polycrystalline Häuslers, but you can make Häuslers single crystalline. A route which has not yet been explored in view of decreasing the damping. So we don't know yet what really limits the damping in the films we have. It's all too fresh area. So there is many things. But the only thing that we can say is there are many ways to explore it. And at the moment, we don't see a brick wall that miniaturization would not work.
Okay.
So you said that the power loss is much worse than the CMOS. So where is the energy going? It's not really the improved Q factor, like the magnet or something, but it's still going in the wires, or where?
It goes into the phonon system at the end. And again, I mean that potentially with magnons you can use less power than with CMOS, because you don't have the eddy current issue. That is a point. What you have is residual coupling to the lattice, which you can tailor. What you have to do is just use materials with low spin orbit coupling, small dimensions. Of course, if you reduce the dimensions, you get some other spin orbit coupling because of the interface problem. But in principle, it should be doable. So it cannot be excluded now that you cannot go into a lower power consumption. And there are many, many issues to be discussed. They're very complex because, of course, you have a lower power consumption if you can show that you can enable certain functionality with less components. And if you think about the biggest obstacle of CMOS, that is still that you have to use different technologies for logic and for memory. That is why you have a multi-core processor. A multi-core processor in itself is not a good concept, because if you have components which can either be logic or either be memory, then you would come up with a very, very different logic behind, where you just dynamically bring the different logic gates together and let them operate as some data processing unit or as some storage unit and so on. So this would basically means that the number of processors, if you like to use these words, is dynamic. And any new technology which might supersede one day CMOS must have this feature. Another feature is, of course, 3D, that you do not want to do it anymore in two dimensions. Yeah? If you want to scale up, you have to look into a technology which could go 3D.
Yeah, we do.
I mean, with the Hoyt's loss, we are just starting. That will be to show that we can realize the same things on a much, much smaller length scale. So the ratio of length scale over decay lengths is the same like we have seen for the YIC devices. Then again, we have to show proof of principle, of course. The material scientists have to further improve the material. We have, for instance, shown that it's very interesting for the magnon transistor. Nonlinear effects can be much stronger in the Hoyt's loss because of compared to what you normally do in a Permalloy, because of the lower thresholds which you have, because of the lower damping.
Does the fact that it's a metal give you additional handles to control the functionalities?
Yeah, it's a half metal. It's a metal only for one spin direction. Yeah. Might be. Yeah.
Well, let's thank the speaker. No further questions.